and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at UAA for an APRN speaker series event with reporter, author, filmmaker, and regular NPR correspondent T.R. Reed. Hosted by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, T.R. Reed's talk, entitled Obama's Health Reform in Plain English, was recorded in Anchorage on March 22nd.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Steve Lindbeck. I'm the President and General Manager of Alaska Public Telecommunications, and I am just thrilled to welcome such a great crowd out here at the Wendy Williamson Arena? Auditorium on a beautiful spring evening, so thank you. I cannot tell you how pleased I am to be here representing a partnership that APTI, Public Broadcasting in South Central Alaska, has created over the years, the last several years, with the Alaska World Affairs Council. We have been doing programming together and attracting great audiences like this and putting together programs that are stimulating and interesting and have been generating larger and larger audiences like this, and that's what we all love to see. This event is not only the partnership with the World Affairs Council, it's also a part of our Alaska Public Radio Network speaker series that is done in support of the Alaska Public Radio Network and the good work that our news team is doing all across Alaska. I don't think I need to share with this crowd how important it is that the capability to tell the news across our state is being preserved, and I just want to thank you all for helping to contribute to that opportunity. So with that, I'm going to get out of the way and let my colleague Lisa Fausco, who is the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, introduce our speaker for tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. In addition to APTI, I'd like to also thank our sponsors for making this possible. Thank you so much to AARP, Arctic Wire and Rope, the Matsu Healthcare Foundation, UAA, and Alaska Dispatch. With your help, we were able to bring T.R. Reed back. And if anyone was able to hear him last year, it came about that whenever I go to different World Affairs Councils, I always ask them, who is your favorite speaker? Who was really a standout? Who was one of those people you have to invite to come and speak to your council? And the name T.R. Reed kept on coming back again and again, so we decided we need to invite this T.R. Reed to come to Alaska. So Steve and APTI got on board, and we invited T.R. Reed, and it was sold out and was so popular that we asked him if he would come back again. And he said yes, he'd be delighted. He loves to snowboard, and we have some snow this year. And so here he is, and we're so excited that we're able to bring this to you. T.R. Reed is one of the nation's best-known correspondents through his coverage of global affairs for the Washington Post, his books, documentary films, and his lighthearted commentaries on National Public Radio. T.R. Reed has reported from 36 countries on 5 continents. He has covered elections ranging from that of the British Prime Minister to Barton County Drain Commissioner. His story revealing the secret engagement of Crown Prince Naruhito is known in Japan as the Dai Sakupu, which is this great scoop. Reed has written and hosted documentary films for National Geographic, for PBS, and for A&E. He's a regular commentator on National Public Radio. His book, The Healing of America, and there are a couple copies left if you're interested, they're at the front desk, was published in 2009 and became a national bestseller. PBS Frontline produced 2 documentary films, A Second Opinion and Sick Around the World, following T.R. Reed as he reported from that book. More recently, he has produced a documentary called U.S. Healthcare, The Good News, which was just shown on KAKM. T.R. Reed is here today to speak to us on the Affordable Health Care Act in plain English. Please join me in welcoming Mr. T.R. Reed.
Hi, everybody. Just great to be here. I'm so delighted that you brought me back to this beautiful state and this beautiful city. I came up a couple of days ago, and I didn't kind of look at the schedule, and somebody booked me on that puddle jumper flight, Seattle, Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau. And I was really ticked off, but, you know, it was such a beautiful day, and that's such a beautiful flight when you get out of Washington and get up to Alaska. It was worth it. I'm glad I did it that way. It was really a good way to do it. And I'm just very pleased to be here with the World Affairs Council and the Public Broadcasting Group for this reason. I really like World Affairs Councils because in all the communities where they operate, they provide a forum for calm and thoughtful discussion of current events, of affairs we Americans have to know. And I'll tell you, well, we all know this. Man, if there's one thing we need in a fractious time in our political life, it's calm and thoughtful civic discussion. And that's what the WACs are providing, so I'm grateful. Another thing we could use a little more of is calm and thoughtful presentation of issues on the airwaves. And that's what public radio and public TV do. So for those of you who are supporting these organizations, I'm grateful and I'm very pleased to be here. Anyway, I like Alaska. Look, I live in Colorado. It's a pretty great state. But I got to say, there's just a lot to like about your state. It's beautiful for a Coloradan. I mean, what, your mountains? Well, I saw Mount McKinley today, though. That's a pretty tall mountain. That's taller than any of ours. The ones out here around Anchorage, they're beautiful, but what are they, 4,500 feet? You know, we call that a hill where I live. But it's kind of like Colorado, except you have the ocean. Colorado with an ocean, that's hard to beat. One thing I really like about Alaska is this gavel-to-gavel program where they show your legislature on TV, and people all over the state tune in. I like this because I have been advocating or lobbying at Rocky Mountain Public Television in Colorado, let's have a state C-SPAN. Let's show the Colorado legislature. And the answer always is, well, nobody would watch it, right? So I'm going to go back and say, well, people in Alaska are watching, you know, so we can too. I'll tell you another thing I think any visitor likes about Alaska, where I live in Colorado. As I said, it's a great state, but everything I buy, I pay a city, a county, and a state sales tax. I pay a state income tax. You guys don't know what that means, but I have to pay it. Property tax, this tax, that tax. And as I understand it, in this state, they pay you to live here, isn't that right? So we could use a PFD where I live. I think there's just a lot to like about and admire in this state. Plus, for breakfast, I had reindeer sausage. We don't have that in Colorado. So I do have one gripe with Alaska, if you don't mind. This year in Colorado, we have had a lousy snow year. It's been terrible. And our skier visits are down 10%. This is really a serious economic blow to our state. And you got our snow. I saw it out there today, mountains of it. So I'm kind of ticked off about that. Now, the reason I got to come to Alaska is because some years ago, I kind of got interested in, I'm just a reporter. I'm not a healthcare expert, believe me. I'm just a reporter, but I got interested in healthcare in other countries. The reason was my American family and I lived in various countries. I was a foreign correspondent. And, you know, when we got sick or when my kids sprained their ankle or something, we went to the local healthcare system and began using them. And, you know, in some degrees, a doctor's office in Britain or Germany or even Japan kind of looks like a doctor's office here. You know, they're nurses in white coats and they're people, you know, taking your blood pressure and stuff. But fairly quickly, we began to realize that healthcare was done differently in those other countries. I'll give you one example. I figured this out pretty early. I don't know what it's like in Alaska. In Colorado, where I live, when I go to the doctor, they keep you waiting in the waiting room forever, right, before you see the doctor. And then a receptionist or a nurse comes out, very casual, and she's got a list, and she says, Tom, are you here, Tom? Like that. It's, you know, it's kind of rude, I think, but that's how they do it. In Japan, I'm sitting in the waiting room in Japan to see the doctor, and the receptionist comes out, and here's what she says. She says, Tomaso Rito-sama irashai maska. And that means, has the highly honorable Thomas Reed honored us with his presence today? Makes you, you know, you feel better already, you know. And the other thing that my wife and I noticed, taking our kids to doctors in these countries, was we were getting really good health care in foreign countries. I mean, the quality of the care was just as good in the United States. We didn't wait any longer, at least in the rich countries where we lived. And the cost was nothing. I mean, the cost was very, very low. In Britain, when we lived in Britain, you never get a doctor bill. You know, the whole system is free. You pay taxes, but no doctor bill, no deductible, no copay, no nothing. It's an interesting way to run healthcare. And it just kind of got me interested as a reporter in other ways to provide healthcare. And the more I looked at it, I discovered this really astonishing to me, really striking fact, and that is all the other countries like us, and I mean by that advanced, high-tech, industrialized, free market democracies. There are about 30 of them in the world. Every one of them provides health care for everybody, high quality care, and in many cases they have better health outcomes than the United States, and on average they spend half as much per capita as we do on health care. So they're getting a lot more and spending a lot less for health care than we do. As you know, in the United States, we have 50 million Americans without health insurance. They get care, but only when they're sick enough to go to the emergency room. And I just got interested as a reporter, how do you do that? How do you cover everybody and spend less? And you know, I wrote a book about it, and are you interested? Would you like to know? I mean, that's the problem. I spoke about that last year when I was in Anchorage. That's not tonight's speech. I've already done that one. So that's not what I'm going to talk about. I will say this, if you want to know, there's a book out there that, you know, Easter is coming, you know, great gift giving. No, tonight, because I talked about that last year here, I'm not allowed to talk about that again. So tonight I've been assigned a different topic, which is even tougher. I mean, it was tough enough to explain how a dozen other countries provide health care to everybody, but this one's even tougher because tonight my job, in a pretty short time, is to explain the most far-reaching, indeed radical, change in America's health care system since 1965, when Medicare was started. And that, of course, would be the 2010 Health Care Reform Act, which is known as in Washington, it's known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. It's the official name, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010. And it won't surprise you a bit to learn that inside the Beltway, this has already been reduced to the acronym PPACA, PPACA, Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. People who don't want to say that mouthful just call it the Affordable Care Act. And people who don't like it, or anybody on Fox News, calls it Obamacare. I don't care which term you use, Obamacare is fine with me. My job tonight is to explain what's in this far-reaching, massive piece of legislation. And I think they gave me half an hour to do it, so I'm just going to have to talk real fast, is I think the solution. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do to get to try to make this intelligible in the brief time I have. Here's the outline. I'm going to first lay out very quickly the problem that this bill set out to fix. Then we'll go through the solutions set forth in this bill. Then I'm just going to talk briefly about the criticism of the bill, the many criticisms of the bill that you've all heard, and we'll go through, and I'll try to be fair-minded about this, which of them are accurate and which of them are not. And then, because it's timely and because it's important, as you know, next week the Supreme Court is going to hear 3 days of arguments on the constitutionality of this bill. So I'm going to talk about the legal challenge, see if we can predict what the Supreme Court's going to do and see if we can figure out what the impact is going to be on the bill depending on how the Supreme Court rules. So that's the pattern. And I told you I'm going to start with the problem, which I'm going to explain very, very quickly. So you may have heard some conflicting things about the United States healthcare system. We hear a lot about our healthcare system. It's, as I think you know, it's our biggest industry. It's a $2.6 trillion industry. One out of every $6 we spend is spent on healthcare in our country. It's a huge part of our economy. It's life and death for people who are sick. It's crucially important, and there are a lot of contradictory things said about it. You may have heard that the United States has the finest healthcare in the world. I'm sure you've heard that. You may have heard that the United States has the most expensive healthcare in the world. Perhaps you've been told that the United States has the most wasteful and the most inefficient healthcare system in the entire world. And perhaps you've heard it said that the United States has the most unfair and most inequitable healthcare system of all the industrialized democracies. And you know what? All of those things are true. They're all true. If you happen to have good insurance or have a lot of money, you're going to get the finest health care in the world in the United States. You've heard members of Congress. On Sunday, I was listening to one of those TV talk shows, and Mitch McConnell, who's the Republican minority leader, the Republican leader in the U.S. Senate, said again, we have the finest health care system in the world. Why would Barack Obama want to mess with it, right? And you know what? For him, it's true. Members of Congress have given themselves a fabulous health care system. It's better than anybody in this room has. It's generous. We pay for almost all of it. They can go to any doctor, any hospital they want, and if they don't like private doctors and hospitals, they can go to any government-run hospital, including any military hospital. And indeed, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the U.S. Senate, who said the private sector will always deliver health care better than big government, that's what he said. When he needed a cardiac bypass, he went to Bethesda Naval Hospital. He had socialized surgery. So some people in our country get the finest health care in the world, that's true. The problem is the people who are left out. According to the Census Bureau, in January this year, 49.9 million Americans didn't have health insurance. And not having health insurance in our country can be a lethal condition. The National Academy of Sciences, this is a study done during the Bush administration, so I think the number is probably worse today, but National Academy of Sciences says 22,000 of our fellow citizens die every year of treatable diseases because they can't afford a doctor. In the richest country in the world, we're letting that happen. So some people get the finest health care in the world. The problem is all the people who are left outside the door. I said we have the most expensive health care in the world. There's no question about that. On a per capita basis, we spend on average twice as much as Britain, Germany, Japan, France, Taiwan, all the other industrialized countries. As a share of GDP, as a share of our national wealth, Britain spends about 9.5% of GDP on healthcare. Germany, they're expensive. They spend about 10.5%. Switzerland, 11%. Canada, your nearby neighbor, 8%. And the United States is spending 17.5% of GDP on healthcare, far more than any other country, even though, as I told you, we leave those 50 million people uninsured. The United States has the most wasteful and the most inefficient healthcare system in the world. I think no question about that. We pay a lot of our healthcare bills through private insurance companies, and the U.S. private insurance companies are the least efficient payers of any system on earth. Our private insurance companies, on average, they have administrative costs, that is paperwork, marketing, payment that doesn't pay for anybody's health care, of about 20 to 30%. That is 30 cents out of every dollar they collect doesn't pay your doctor bills. It goes to pay their salaries and their marketing and stuff like that. let's compare that to some other places. In Britain, everything is done by government. It's socialized medicine. Government pays all the bills. Administrative costs, 5%. Germany is a private system with private insurance companies. Administrative costs, 6.5%. Anybody here think of France as a paradigm of management efficiency? They have a system, 62 million people. It covers everybody in France. The insurance company pays your claim in one day. Anybody have that deal? Administrative costs in France, 5.5%. Our insurance companies are spending four times as much just on the paperwork. So the most wasteful and inefficient system in the world, and of all the rich countries, the most unfair and inequitable for the reason I told you. Some people in America get the world's finest care with no limit, and 22,000 of our fellow Americans die every year of treatable diseases because we don't treat them, because they can't afford care. Another large number, there's a debate about how big the number, but roughly 700,000 or 800,000 of our fellow citizens go bankrupt every year because of medical bills. Perfectly decent people, most of them have jobs. They get hit by a truck or they get a cancer diagnosis and they lose everything they've ever saved. No other country lets that happen. So all those things I said about our healthcare system are true. And in 2008, we had a presidential candidate, Barack Obama, who emphasized these problems and promised to fix them. He promised that he was going to cut the cost of U.S. health care and provide health care for every American. Do you remember this promise? He said it in every speech. So let's see how he did. What he did was he came up with this bill. It took them in a very, very intense 14 months to get it through Congress and get it passed. He signed it about 14 months after he was inaugurated. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, it's insanely complicated. I mean, nobody would want to read this piece of legislation. I did. I'll save you the time. It's 404,000 words. This is four times the length of my book, and I did every healthcare system in the world. But since they gave me very little time here and I'm talking as fast as I can, I'm going to explain it to you. I think the best way to explain it is to reduce it to four basic points. There are four basic things that this bill does, although I'm even cheating saying that, as you'll see in a minute. And the four things are, first, it expands coverage. It tries to do something about these tens of millions of Americans who don't have health insurance and many of whom die because of it. Second, it provides new regulation of our health insurers in ways that they've never been regulated before. It outlaws some of the crueler practices of the insurance industry. Third, this costs a lot of money to expand coverage and to get control over the insurance companies is very expensive. It's going to cost, the official price tag for this bill is $938 billion over 10 years, let's say $940 billion. And under its own terms, the bill pays every penny. It has new taxes that raises $940 billion. So I think paying for it is the third factor. I told you we're going to do expansion of coverage, insurance regulation, paying for it, and then the fourth factor, I told you I was going to cheat. The fourth factor is all the other stuff, which is the only way. There's so much in there, it's the only way to deal with it. Okay, so let's start with the expansion of coverage. Do you remember the number I told you? The Census Bureau says 49.9 million Americans in January of this year didn't have health insurance. This is a function of employment rates. It's a function of how much insurance costs. It's a function of the insurance companies turning you down because there are about 20 to 25 million Americans who would like to have health insurance and could afford it, but the companies won't cover them because they were sick once. And the insurance companies, the last thing they want to do is sell a policy to anybody who might make a claim. Yeah, that wouldn't be good. And so the people who most need health insurance in America are not allowed to buy it. That's how we have 50 million people uninsured. We also have a group of people, about 12 to 15 million people, who are healthy, who could buy health insurance, and they don't. They'd rather spend the money on a ski trip to Alyeska or something like that, or go to Hawaii. I call those people the freeloaders, because when they have an accident, they show up in the emergency room anyway, and we don't let them die. We treat them. And guess what? They don't have insurance, so the bill is passed on to you and me. There are about 15 million of those freeloaders. So among those 50 million people, the idea of Obamacare is to expand coverage, get a lot more people with some kind of insurance coverage. And the bill contemplates 32 million more people will get health insurance coverage by 2016 or 2017 when it takes full effect. They do this in two ways. 16 million of those people are going to be put into Medicaid programs. Medicaid is the government-run and government-financed program for poor people, for low-income people. And the way they get 16 million more people on it is they've just changed the definition of what low income is. So people today who can't get Medicaid coverage will get it starting in 2014 when this bill takes effect. Are you with me in this? That's 16 million people. And then another 16 million people are going to get health care through the private insurance companies, because under this bill, the insurance companies can't turn you down anymore. If you were sick once but you want insurance, you'll be able to buy it. And the government, if you can't afford the premium, the government will help your family pay the premium for private health insurance. And that expansion of private insurance, I think, brings us to the most important single innovation in this bill, and that's something called an insurance exchange. Anybody know what that means? Nobody in America knows what this means. It's the centerpiece of the most important change in health insurance in 60 years, but no, we don't know. They haven't explained it. I blame the White House for this. People think an insurance exchange is a building downtown where you go buy a policy, right? Here's what an insurance exchange is. It's Expedia, it's Orbitz, it's Amazon.com. It's an online market where you go on the internet and find an health insurance policy for your family. Under the law, every state has to offer at least 5 different plans that'll work for any family. Some states are going to have as many as 21. I think in my state, Colorado, we're going to have at least 8 plans for everybody. You go down on the internet, you pick the insurance plan that's best for you and your family, you choose it, they have to cover you. They can't turn you down, even if you were sick a few years ago. They can't turn you down, and the government will help you pay your premium. That is, for most people. For a family of 4 with an income as high as $92,000 a year, the government will subsidize the premium. So to me, this is a good thing. This is at least 16 million people who are going to now have the opportunity to choose among 5 to 8 to 20 different insurance plans on the internet, where it's pretty easy. All the plans will be explained. The prices have to be made quite clear. And if you can't quite afford the premium, the government's going to help you buy insurance. This is a good thing. I just don't see how anybody can be against this. And this is going to help mainly 2 groups of people. People who are self-employed or unemployed but want to buy insurance. That's called the individual market. And then people who work for small employers, and that's defined as a company with 49 or fewer employees is defined in this bill as a small employer. And anybody who works at a company like that can get insurance on the exchange. Are you following me? People who now get insurance from their employer, or maybe they don't get insurance from their employer, are going to get it on the exchange. And the critics of the bill have argued, well, this is terrible because there have been studies. They've gone out and surveyed businesses that now provide some level of insurance, and 30% of them have said, I'm going to drop the insurance and let my people go on the exchange. If you do that, if a business does that, they have to pay a fine, but the fine is only $2,000 per employee per year. That's cheaper than buying insurance. So many businesses will do this. Now, does this sound like a criticism to you? Is this a bad thing? that people are going to lose their employer-sponsored insurance? The critics say, yeah, this is terrible. If you watch Fox News, they love this factoid that 30% of companies are going to drop coverage and put their employees in the exchange. To me, I think it's a good thing, because most of the people getting, not counting government employees, but most of the people with working for private employers who get health insurance through their employer have no choice. You get the one plan, or maybe at the most two plans, that your employer decides to offer. Are you with me on this? I don't know what the number is in Alaska. In my state, Colorado, which is pretty normal, of all the people who have insurance, 50% of them only get one choice, the one company that their employer offers. I worked for the Washington Post for years as a very generous Fortune 500 company. I got one choice. I had no competition, and therefore the insurance company, they had no interest in taking care of me. They weren't going to lose me. I couldn't go outside and get insurance. So now these people, the employer will pay less, and these people will go to the exchange and have a big choice. Are you with me on this? I think it's a better deal, frankly, and the government will help you pay. But anyway, this is the most important change, and the thought is, if the exchange works, if people like it and use it intelligently in the way they buy things from Amazon and Orbitz and Expedia, then it will expand and more people will move on to the exchange. In my view, as I say, I think that would be a good thing, but some people say that's critical. So that's the expansion of coverage. 32 million more people will have access to health insurance. I'm going to skip over here what I hope has already struck you as an obvious gap. I told you there are 50 million people without insurance, and Obamacare is only going to get new insurance for 32 million of them. Do you hear the gap there? Well, I'll get to that problem later. That's a serious problem.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with T.R. Reid, reporter, author, filmmaker, and regular NPR correspondent. His talk, entitled Obama's Health Reform in Plain English, was recorded in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at the University of Alaska Anchorage on Thursday, March 22nd.
Now, one thing you won't find on these exchanges when you go down the list of insurance plans you could choose from, you won't find a government-run insurance plan. You won't find what's known as the public option. And when this bill was debated, you may remember that term, a lot of people said, well, if we're going to require people to buy insurance, don't make them all buy from private companies. Give them, let the government compete with them. And when Barack Obama was running for president, he always said, we need to have a public option to keep the private insurers honest, keep their rates down, make them treat customers better, so that because they'll be afraid of the competition. Are you with me on this? But there is no public option in this bill. That was negotiated away because the private insurers fought this. Now, you know, these are very successful private sector companies. They're run by Harvard and Stanford MBAs who make $30 million a year, but for some reason, they were afraid to compete against the U.S. government. And therefore, they killed the public option. That's not in there. So the insurance exchange that I told you about is going to have a choice of 5 to 8 to 20 private insurance plans. Depends on the state. I don't know what the Alaska plan is. States are now setting up these exchanges. The insurance companies successfully fought off the threat of a public option. But to do it, they had to give up some stuff. They had to compromise. And what they gave up, what the government got, or the Obama administration got in return for dropping the public option, was a series of new regulations governing health insurance that have never been in effect before. The insurers have never before accepted these rules. Okay, so what are these rules? Well, the most important one is what's called guaranteed issue, and that is they have to sell you the policy. If you want a health insurance policy, it doesn't matter if you had cancer last year or if you have psoriasis or arthritis now. They have to sell you the policy. They have to sell the policy to everybody. This is the way health insurance works in every other country. In all the other rich countries, the insurers have to cover everybody. And our companies have never done that. They've always been quite selective about who they'd cover. But now they're going to have to issue a policy to everybody. Now, and that will provide insurance, as I said, for about 20 million people who today would like to buy insurance and they can't get it because they're sick now, or they were sick, or they've been diagnosed as pre-diabetic. But to make that work, to make guaranteed issue work without driving the insurance companies bankrupt, the insurance companies need something else, and that is they need the mandate that everybody buy insurance. If they're going to have to cover you when you apply, their fear is that people are going to wait until they get a cancer diagnosis and then buy insurance. If you think about this as an insurance company, if a guy can call you up when he sees a fire in his basement and then buy fire insurance, you're going to lose your shirt. And this is the problem for the insurance companies. Well, we can't take everybody who applies unless everybody has to be in the risk pool. This is called, this is fundamental risk 101. You learn it in any business school in the first week of the insurance class. Get everybody in the pool, and then the insurers can afford to pay for those, the minority of people who get sick during the year. Are you with me on this? Those two have to go together. The individual mandate has to be there, or the insurance companies can't provide guaranteed issue. And this is true in every country. In every country, every rich country, the mandate to buy insurance and the requirement that they cover you, this is 2 + 2 = 4. It's absolutely, they have to go together. You can't be without it. And what we've heard in the current campaign, of course, is all the Republican candidates despise the mandate to buy insurance. How dare they? How dare they make me buy a product? Big government, of all things. But they all like guaranteed issue. You with me on this? They all like the idea that the insurance company has to cover you, but they don't like the mandate that everybody cover. And if you're for guaranteed issue, but you're against the mandate to buy insurance, this is the equivalent of taking a tough stand in favor of the calorie-free hot fudge sundae, right? It can't happen. It doesn't exist. And these two, but so the Obamacare bill does what has to be done, and any economist, any insurance executive will tell you this. If you're going to make them cover everybody, everybody's got to be in the pool. You're with me on this? It does this, but as we're going to see later, that mandate provision, which is absolutely essential, is being challenged and may be ruled out by the Supreme Court. In addition, the bill outlaws a bunch of really cruel practices that our insurance companies invented over the years. One is called rescission. Rescission is a fancy word for you're canceled. And the insurance companies have had this practice for years in which you pay your premium every month, and as long as all you have is a sprained ankle or a hangnail or an earache or something, they pay the bills. But when you get hit by a truck or you get cancer, they cancel you. That's called rescission. They do it to hundreds of thousands of people every year, people who are paying their policies on time. And as soon as the bill gets too big, they cancel. To me, this is a reprehensible practice. When I was making a film about this, I used to go in and interview the presidents of the insurance companies and say, why would you cancel on people who are paying their bills on time? And they kind of squirm. Even they are really embarrassed about this practice. It's now against the law. They can't do that anymore. Another thing they used to do is they used to have these yearly limits. Yeah, we'll cover your medical bills, you know, and we're really generous. We'll cover them up to $400,000 a year, you know, and that's good. That's fine for most people until you get hit by a truck on the street. And then you're looking at $1 million worth of bills. And the insurance company sends you a letter and says, we'll pay the first $400,000. You can pay the other $600,000 out of your bank account. This happens to people, and that's now outlawed too. They can't do that anymore. Finally, the bill, for the first time in American history, sets some limit on these high administrative costs. You remember I told you they spend 20% to 30% on paperwork and marketing? And the original bill said they can't spend more than 10% of their premium dollar on paperwork and administration. They got to spend 90% on medical bills. Now, this, to me, is not an outlandish requirement, because if you look at Germany, is private insurance, their companies spend 95% of their take on medical bills. Switzerland, 95%. Japan is about 97%. In other words, in other countries, this is standard. But our insurance companies fought this tooth and nail. No, no, nobody could possibly provide health insurance and spend 95% of the income on bills. We couldn't do that. So in the end, the Obamacare bills compromised at 80%. They're allowed to spend 20 cents of every dollar they take in on other stuff, not medical bills. To me, it's not enough, but it's an improvement. So that's another insurance change. And as I said, the insurance companies only accepted all this as a trade-off for getting rid of the public option. Let me tell you a few things that Obamacare didn't do about the insurance market. Do you know this business where the insurance company has an in-network doctor and an out-of-network doctor? Anybody have a plan like that? Yeah. We'll pay for Dr. Jones, but if your neighbor says, gee, Dr. White was really good to me, we don't pay Dr. White. Too bad, not in our network. No other country allows that. All the other rich countries, you choose the doctor, you choose the hospital, you choose the chiropractor, and insurance has to pay. It's only in the United States that we've allowed insurance companies to dictate which doctors and hospitals you can choose. They decide, not you. They didn't change that. They're still allowed to do that under Obamacare. The insurance industry employs about 100,000 people who are called adjusters, and their job is to go through when you submit a claim from your doctor or hospital and find a reason to deny it. Anybody here ever had a health insurance claim denied? Yeah, it's pretty common. There's a debate about how many, but it's pretty common. In all the other countries, the insurance companies are not allowed to deny a claim. If a doctor or hospital certifies the claim, they have to pay it. That's not an Obamacare. They now have to report annually how many of the claims they denied, which they've never reported before, but they're still allowed to do it. There are some things that we might have done, learned from other countries that we didn't do, but that's the insurance regulation part of Obamacare, and a lot of these changes are for the good. They eliminate some practices that really were not that were reprehensible. Let's be fair about it. Just disgusting, I think. I told you that there are all these changes in the bill, and the major one is expanding Medicaid, which is a government-paid program, and providing a subsidy for tens of millions of Americans to buy health insurance, and that's really expensive. How much? Well, the official price tag prepared by the Obama administration and accepted by the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of the scorekeeper, is $938 billion over 10 years. That's why they call it a trillion-dollar health reform, because it is just about that. And sure enough, when Barack Obama says all the time, he says, this bill is not going to add a penny to the deficit because we've paid for all the spending. Well, it's true that there are $940 billion over 10 years of new taxes in this bill. It does raise taxes. I like this system because they've done the new taxes in a pretty smart way. They've loaded the new taxes mainly onto the people who are going to be big winners from the bill. Drug companies, medical device makers, like the people who make shoulders and knees, insurance companies, and hospital corporations. They're going to pay more in tax. Well, fine. They're going to make out like bandits. I don't want to use the term bandits. They're going to make out fine on this bill. It makes sense that they should pay. So, you see, and so this is what Barack Obama means when he says it's not going to add a penny to the deficit, because my official price tag is $940 billion. And I got $940 billion of taxes in there. Now, the critics, the Republicans, say this is a budget-busting health care reform. It's going to add trillions to our deficit. My judgment on this is that the critics are right. I think they're right, because $940 billion is a phony number. That's not really what it's going to cost. It's going to cost a heck of a lot more than that. To get to that number, they had to assume things and manipulate things and leave things out. You know how they do in Washington. And so my guess, everybody, even the Congressional Budget Office as of last week, now agrees that the bill is going to cost vastly more than the $940 billion they're going to raise. And therefore, it probably is a budget buster. But you got to give them credit. The amount of money that they say they're going to spend, they did raise taxes enough to make up that amount. I just want to contrast that to a previous health care reform, Medicare Part D, where they expanded Medicare to cover seniors' prescriptions. That one cost $800 billion over 10 years, and they didn't raise taxes by a penny. Every penny of that $800 billion was added to the deficit. They just borrowed the money for that. In sharp contrast, you got to give Obama credit for at least raising taxes to pay the amount that he says the bill is going to cost. Are you following me here? But I don't think it's enough. So I think it probably is a budget-busting bill, but not as bad as it could have been if they hadn't raised taxes. I just want to point out one other interesting tax change in this bill. Anybody who works for a salary or for pay has to pay 2.9% of your paycheck for Medicare. There's a Medicare tax. Do you ever look at the stub? Comes out of every paycheck if somebody is paying you a wage, a salary. If you happen to make your money trading CDOs, trading securities, or on dividends, or trading mortgage documents, if you make your money in high finance, there is no Medicare tax. Those people make more money than people on salary, but they've never had to pay the 2.9% tax. Now, the Medicare tax is going to pay to those apply to those financial earnings as well. To me, that seems fairer. And for rich people, I think over $250,000 a year, they're going to raise it to 3.8%. And they did that to bring in some of this $940 billion. To me, that's a fair change. I've always thought that people operating in high finance should have to pay for Medicare like everybody else does. They qualify for Medicare. They've just never paid for it. One other area where they're going to save money is this business called a Medicare Advantage plan. I bet some people here are on Medicare Advantage plans. Medicare Advantage is an interesting program. When Medicare was getting in the 1990s, the cost of Medicare went up very rapidly, and the private insurance company said, oh, Medicare, it's a wasteful government program. You know, those wasteful, lazy government bureaucrats, they're inefficient. And the private insurance company said, we could provide the same benefits as Medicare for a lot less. And so they set up this system called Medicare Advantage, where you buy Medicare coverage, but you don't pay the government. You pay an insurance company. And the insurance companies promised the government that they could, they're so much more efficient, that they could do this for 95% of the government premium. That is, if you were paying $100 a month to Medicare, for 95 bucks a month, the insurance companies would provide the same coverage. Are you aware this is called Medicare Advantage? And guess what happened? They couldn't do it for $95 a month. They couldn't even do it for $100 a month. They couldn't do it for $105 a month. And so they kept going back to Congress and saying, you know, eventually we're going to be really efficient, but for right now we just need some startup money. And so today they charge $114 a month for the same service that Medicare provides for $100. And the government pays the extra $14. Obama eliminates that. He eliminates that subsidy to the insurance companies, and this is a fairly major part of paying for the $940 billion. By some estimates, it's $500 million, and if you've listened to the Republican debates, they all say Obama is cutting Medicare for our seniors by $500 million, right? What he's really doing is cutting government subsidies to rich insurance companies. But, you know, that's for Medicare, so that's the argument. Okay, so that's the cost and how we pay for it. They are paying for it. My argument is I would say they're not paying enough. And finally, I just have a minute to go through all the other stuff that's in the bill. We did the expansion of coverage. We did insurance regulation. I just went through the payment scheme. So here's what's in this bill. Under this bill, every chain restaurant in the United States, McDonald's, Krispy Kreme, Dairy Queen, Kentucky, all of them are going to have to list the calories on every item on their menu and tell you. So that if you go in to buy a Krispy Kreme donut, maybe you'll look at it and say, 624 calories. No, maybe I'll have a bagel. But the bagel stores also have to list. And candy vending machines selling food articles also have to list. So if you throw in 50 cents to get a bag of Fritos, it's going to tell you how many calories in there. That's in this bill. One of the problems with American healthcare is we don't have enough primary care doctors. About 30 to 35% of our doctors are providing primary care. And primary care doctors can often do what a specialist does, particularly in the early stage of a disease, for a lot less money. We want more primary care doctors, but this is a problem because a primary care doctor in America makes on average of $160,000, $170,000 a year, and a radiologist makes $480,000 a year. If you're coming out of medical school with a big debt, which would you choose? And so under Obamacare, we're going to raise the pay of primary care doctors to try to get more young doctors to do that work. This is a good change, I think. Obamacare included a government-run long-term care plan for seniors if you had to go into the nursing home or if you had to have home health care when you're old. That was in the bill, but 2 years later, they axed it. The Health and Human Services Division just cut it off because they couldn't make it pay for itself. It was never going to pay for itself. So that's gone. And then, the donut hole, anybody senior here probably knows what the donut hole is. The Medicare Part D pays for about $2,600 or $2,700 a year of prescriptions. And then for the next $2,000, you have to pay it out of your pocket. And after that, the government kicks in again. This was part of the Medicare drug program. They did it just to save money. It's called the donut hole because you pay through here, you don't pay here, you pay the hole, and then you get paid again. And Obamacare fills the donut hole. Over a few years, seniors won't have to pay this large amount for a prescription drug. So that's a good change. And then the part of Obamacare that terrifies doctors. If you want to scare your neighbor, the doctor, just say this terrifying word, IPAB. Anybody heard of the IPAB? IPAB, I-P-A-B, it's the Independent Payment Advisory Board. And under the bill, this is a board of people appointed by the president and by leaders in Congress. I think they serve a 15-year term. They're not allowed to have any other income, so they can't take money from the drug companies or the hospital companies. And they are going to set the prices for every procedure that Medicare pays. Doctors hate this because they think the IPAB will reduce their fees. I think that's right. That's the whole purpose of the IPAB, is to reduce the outcome. And then in theory, the private insurance companies will probably say, well, if Medicare is only paying that much for a new knee, that's all I'm going to pay. So IPAB could have a very powerful impact on reducing the cost of medical care in our country, or at least reducing the rate of increase. And I don't know if anybody's watching Congress, the House of Representatives yesterday passed a bill repealing the IPAB. This is big government intrusion into your medicine. It's government getting between you and your doctor kind of thing. We need to get some control over healthcare costs. It's very difficult to do politically. So I personally thought the idea of an independent board setting prices was not bad, but you can understand why doctors and hospitals would hate this idea. So it's pretty controversial, but it's in there. Okay, so I've now given you, three big factors and then kind of a miscellany of other little stuff, not so little, but other stuff that's in the bill. That's what's in the bill. This is why I had to talk so fast. There's actually a lot more in there, but that's the major stuff. Now let's talk a little bit about the criticisms of this bill, because I think the Democrats thought, man, I think Barack Obama thought he was going to be a hero of the realm for passing the first major health care reform in 60 years and pushing it through Congress, because this is what he promised to do in his campaign. And as a matter of fact, he's been badly burned by it. Everybody criticizes it. I think in the latest polls, about 44 to 45% of Americans say it's probably okay, and 51% of Americans say let's repeal it. And there's a lot of criticism of this bill. You've heard it. So let's just go down through some of these criticisms. And I'll tell you, just my personal judgment, it's my judgment whether I think these criticisms are true or false, okay? You're totally free to disagree with me. That's fine. These are all judgment calls. First of all, it's a government takeover of healthcare. You heard this? Big government's going to get between me and my doctor. Government's taking over healthcare. False. My judgment is false. If Obamacare takes full effect, about 85% of all the people under 65 in the United States are going to have private doctors, private hospitals, and private insurance. It expands private insurance, as I told you earlier. It's not a government takeover of medicine, not a fair charge. In Colorado, maybe you have these in Alaska too, in Colorado, we have bumper stickers that say, repeal the job-killing health care reform. It's a job killer, right? You've heard this? False. Since that bill was passed, our economy has added nearly 4 million jobs, 3.8 million jobs. One-third of them have been in health care. The healthcare industry is gearing up. They're hiring up to get this expanded coverage that the bill's going to provide. So it has definitely not killed jobs. Okay, next question. This bill is so complicated, right? It's 2,500 pages. It's 404,000 words. It's four times the length of a very good best-selling book. Blah, blah, blah. It's so complicated that nobody knows what's in it, including the people who voted for it. And you know what? I think this charge is true. It's just an incredibly, insanely complicated bill, because when they were writing it, the Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate. They had a big majority in the House. They knew they could get anything through, so they just threw in the kitchen sink. They just threw in all this stuff, more stuff than I've been able to tell you in this short amount of time. It's incredibly complicated, and it's true that members of Congress don't know what's in it, the people who voted for it. I was asked to speak at a program run by the Commonwealth Foundation in New York. It's a great outfit. They run a program every year for members of Congress to talk about health care. And right after this bill was signed in 2010, they had about 55 members of Congress for a briefing on the Affordable Care Act, the bill they had just passed, right? And the Commonwealth had two economists stand up and go through, in much more detail than I've done, what's in the bill. And I looked over, and all these members of Congress are taking notes. You know, they're all writing this down, because they didn't know. It's way more complicated than any piece of legislation should be. That's a true criticism. It's a budget-busting health reform. Well, as I told you, I think that's basically true. I think it's going to cost a heck of a lot more than the advertised price tag. It's going to cost a lot more than the new taxes will bring in, so I think that's true. And then I mentioned this before, there's this criticism, well, a lot of companies will drop their health care plans and force their employers into the exchange, this computer online market. That's true, but as I told you, I think it's a good thing. I think workers will come out better. Certainly when I was working for the Washington Post, I would have been better for my family having an exchange and having a choice of plans rather than the one plan the company gave me. So that charge is true, but I don't think it's a criticism. Okay. Now let me just talk, I've taken so long. Let me just talk briefly about this legal case that's going to be argued in the Supreme Court for 3 days next week. The fundamental charge against this bill is, as I told you, the government has a mandate that you buy insurance. And if you don't have a health insurance plan, the IRS is going to tax you about $700 a year. And the argument from the critics is, government can't do that. This just goes too far. You know, government can, you know, it can make you pay your taxes. It can make you drive under 75 on the highway. It can, you know, do a lot of stuff. But they can't mandate that you buy a product from private business. And interestingly, the very people who most opposed the public option are now the people arguing in the Supreme Court, since there's no public option, the bill is unconstitutional, right? It's an interesting argument. Three federal trial courts, district courts, and three circuit courts, courts of appeals, have ruled on this. And just to simplify greatly, Obama, his bill has been supported 2-1 on a 2-1 level in those courts. And now it goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to have to decide whether the individual mandate is a constitutional exercise of government power. Are you with me this far? What's going to happen? One view is that this Supreme Court is a very political Supreme Court. And when they get a political case like Bush v. Gore or like that handgun decision in D.C., they make the political decision. And if that's the case, then the five conservatives on the court could be expected to throw out Barack Obama's insurance mandate. Another view is that actually the whole case turns on constitutional interpretation. It turns on whether the Commerce Clause in the Constitution is strong enough to give Congress the power to make you buy insurance. And if you look at the current members of the court, including the conservatives, many of them have argued in previous cases that, yeah, the commerce power is huge and certainly goes far enough to make people buy a private product. They've held this before, which would suggest that they'll uphold the mandate and uphold Barack Obama's law. I think it's just a guess. It's just a guess. But my guess is that the court will vote to uphold the mandate and to uphold this law. And I think the main reason for that is something that a great, great Supreme Court Justice, Robert Jackson, said in a case, one of the many cases when Franklin Roosevelt was trying to dig us out of the Depression with New Deal legislation. And I don't know if you remember this, but a conservative Supreme Court kept throwing out these New Deal laws because they were overreaching. And Roosevelt said, look, I'm trying to fix a great national crisis, the Depression, and the Supreme Court won't let me. And this kind of, there was a change of mind when Robert Jackson came on the Supreme Court in about 1938. And he wrote a famous opinion that said, look, we have a huge national problem here. And the President and Congress have come up with this New Deal legislation in an effort to fix a national problem. And don't tell us that the Constitution forces us to live with national problems and not fix them. He said, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. He said, when there's a huge national problem facing the country, the Constitution believes that the federal government should have the power to act in a reasonable way to deal with that problem. And my guess is that's where the Supreme Court's going to end up here. Because if they throw out Obamacare, well, then we go back to 50 million people uninsured, right? We go back to healthcare costs going up at double and triple the rate of inflation every year. We go back to 22,000 people dying of treatable diseases every year because they can't see a doctor. Are you with me on this? Healthcare is a big national problem in our country, and I think in the end, maybe the justices will say, I don't really like what Congress did, but it's a big problem and Congress has the right to act on it. That's my guess, but it's just a guess. Now, I just want to say in closing what the bill doesn't do. Two important things the bill doesn't do. In the first place, we have this incredibly complicated, fragmented, crazy quilt system of healthcare. There are dozens and dozens of different payers, private insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, the Native Health Service, the VA, the TRICARE for active duty. We just have dozens of overlapping. They all have their own rules. They all have their own prices. They all have their own forms. Go to any hospital in Alaska, and they're going to have a bunch of offices up on the top floor that are just full of forms and dozens of people whose job is to file the bills. And this is all money that doesn't pay for anybody's health care. It's just paperwork costs. Obamacare doesn't do a thing about that. In fact, Obamacare makes our system more complicated. It creates more overlap and more different payment schemes. And this is a serious shortcoming of the bill. But the most important shortcoming, I think I've already telegraphed my feeling. To me, it seems absolutely essential as a fiscal matter, as a medical matter, and as a moral imperative that a decent, rich democracy should provide health care for everybody. That seems to me to be an absolute basic. And as I told you at the beginning, all the other countries like us, rich democracies, provide health care for everybody. We're the only one that leaves tens of millions uninsured. And you know what? This big, expansive, 404,000-word health care reform still leaves 23 to 25 million people uninsured when it takes full effect in 2017. To me, that's the fundamental shortcoming of the law. So here's what I'm telling you. Incredibly complicated. The critics are right on some points. The critics are wrong on some points. What it does would improve our current system, but it would still leave 23 million Americans without health insurance, and to me, that's not the reform we need. Thank you.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with reporter, author, filmmaker, and regular NPR correspondent T.R. Reid. The Alaska World Affairs Council, in partnership with Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, hosted T.R. Reid at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium as part of the APRN Speaker Series held on March 22nd. If you would like to hear the question and answer portion of the program that followed Mr. Reid's lecture, go to alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.